Now then to the 32nd chapter of Genesis and to the account of Jacob at Peniel. Last Lord's Day evening we considered the subject of private prayer in general, and we said that it is essential to the Christian life because there is so much in any Christian life that must be honestly and seriously reckoned with in one's life before God and in one's conversation with God and in one's petitions made to God that cannot be uttered in public with others present and listening. Tonight I want to consider one of the great portraits of such private prayer painted for us in God's Word, namely Jacob's encounter with the angel of the Lord and his wrestling with him at Peniel. So let's read verses 22 through 32 of Genesis Chapter 32. That night Jacob got up and took his two wives, his two maidservants, and his 11 sons and crossed the ford of the Jabbok. Jacob is on his way home after many years in Paddan Aram, working and living with his uncle Laban. After he had sent them across the stream, he sent over all his possessions. Jacob apparently sensed the need to be alone. What unfolds seems to be what he wished for, what he was hoping for, even if he did not know exactly what form this encounter with God might take. But in any case, it does not seem to be a particular surprise that Jacob should have such a night, having, as it were, seeming to plan for it as he did. So Jacob was left alone, and a man wrestled with him till daybreak. What a remarkably Spartan narrative this is. When the man saw that he could not overpower him, he touched the socket of Jacob's hip, so that his hip was wrenched as he wrestled with the man. Then the man said, "Let me go, for it is daybreak." Why does he want to be let go? Because it is starting to dawn. The best idea seems to be that he desires to continue to hide his identity because, being God, he may not be seen. Even in human dress, the holiness of God poses a danger to man. This is the point Jacob himself draws attention to in verse 30, which seems to confirm that meaning in the statement the angel of the Lord makes. But Jacob replied, "I will not let you go unless you bless me." The man asked him, "What is your name?" "Jacob," he answered. Now, the man knew what his name was, so the fact that he elicits this information is obviously significant. The name in the Old Testament is so often a revelation of character. In this case, particularly, as Jacob came from a verb meaning to clutch, because when he was born, remember, he was clutching the heel of his elder twin brother. But it also came to mean supplanter, from a verb with a similar sound, meaning to take by the heel or to overtake. Jacob had supplanted. He had overtaken his brother by deceit, and so giving his name to this man with whom he wrestled was in effect a confession of his corrupted character. Jacob said, 28. Then the man said, "Your name will no longer be Jacob, but Israel." Israel means he struggles with God. "Because you have struggled with God and with men and have overcome." Jacob said, "Please tell me your name." But he replied, "Why do you ask my name?" Then he blessed him there. God is extraordinarily careful about his holy name. So Jacob called the place Peniel, saying, "It is because I saw God's face, because I saw God face to face, and yet my life was spared." Now this is clearly a theophany, an appearance of God in human form. A pre-incarnate appearance of almost certainly the second person of the Trinity, because the information of the Scripture so far as it is given to us always suggests that these appearances of God were the appearances of the Son, of God the Son. God has done this before now. Remember in chapter 18, he appears to Abraham before the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah. And afterward, he will do it again. He will appear, for example, to Joshua before Jericho and so on. In the history of salvation, this is clearly a preparation for the incarnation, but it is also a powerful demonstration of God's active involvement in the life of his people. He is not Hey, God sitting with sitting stolidly with his arms folded on some cosmic hillside, watching to see what will come of the world he has made. He is involved and active in the course of his people's lives and the history of the world. So Jacob called the place Peniel. The sun rose above him as he passed Peniel, and he was limping because of his hip. God withdrew as the dawn came, so that Jacob would not be harmed by seeing his face directly, and by the sunrise, Jacob finds himself alone. Therefore, to this day, the Israelites do not eat the tendon attached to the socket of the hip, because the socket of Jacob's hip was touched near the tendon. Now, I want to dispense with one matter, by the by, as something of an aside here at the beginning of our consideration of this chapter, just because it's often brought up in sermons and studies of this particular text. And it is the oft-made assumption in preaching that this is the point, that Peniel is the point of Jacob's conversion to real faith in God. That up to this point, Jacob was really an unbeliever, did not have the new heart and real faith in God. Lloyd-Jones, for example, is one of many preachers who took the narrative that way, and he expounds it as a case, as one of the great cases of conversion in the Bible, and therefore the meaning of conversion. I'm not so sure of this. In fact, I'm not at all persuaded. Remember, Bethel lies many years behind us now, where Jacob saw the ladder reaching up to heaven with the angels of God descending and ascending on it. And there he made a vow of loyalty to God, which you can read in Genesis 28. And there are certainly indications that when Jacob was living in Paddan Aram, living with and working for Laban, his uncle, he still saw his life in terms of God's faithfulness to him. Chapter 31, verses 3 through 5 and 10 through 13 and 42 and 50 are examples of Jacob reckoning with the Lord in his life there, and especially 32, 9 through 12, which we'll get to in a short while. It is speculation, I think, largely based on the fact that the English-speaking church, largely because of the eclipse of the doctrine we were considering this morning, assumes that any major figure in the Bible has to have had a conversion experience. And so, if information is provided, we go looking to see when that conversion occurred. There's really nothing in the narrative of Jacob that indicates that he wasn't a true believer in God when still in his father Isaac's house, for that matter. As the Bible makes all too clear, believers can do very sinful things and betray their faith in many different ways. But now, this account of Jacob and his encounter with God. This is one of the great dramatic episodes in all of the Bible. And in a single moment, the entire position of the Christian faith is laid bare and becomes clear. Now, you remember the general outline of Jacob's personal history leading him up to this moment in his life. How he had antagonized his brother Esau. First, by taking advantage of him when he was tired and hungry and getting him to trade away his birthright, which belonged to him by rights as the elder brother. However foolish that may have been on Esau's part, it was deceit on Jacob's part. Clearly a grasping after something that did not belong to him, and you can imagine how it must have rankled in the years that followed, especially to Esau. To make matters much worse, he stole Esau's blessing, the blessing that his father intended to bestow on the eldest son, by pretending to be Esau and deceiving his old blind father, who thought he was blessing Esau, when in fact he was blessing Jacob. The pretender, the supplanter. After that outrage, he had to flee the wrath of his brother, who threatened to kill him, and made his way to Paddan Aram, where he was to live and work for many years, marry two sisters, first Leah and then Rachel, sire 11 of his 12 sons and his only daughter, Dinah. He prospered there and he became wealthy. Although, to be honest, his conduct was not in all respects commendable. And finally, because of a growing rift with his uncle Laban, was instructed by the Lord to return to the land of his father. But as he neared the promised land, the old problem loomed before him again. What would Esau do upon his return? Would the old grudge still be burning after these many years? Does Esau still intend to kill his brother, the threat that made Jacob flee his father's house those many years before? As he neared the territory that his brother occupied, he sent messengers ahead to inform Esau that he was coming, by which probably he primarily intended to sniff out Esau's intentions and to discover the lay of the land, to test the waters. And they returned with the alarming news that Esau was coming to meet him and had in his company 400 armed men. Jacob prayed about this in verses 9 through 12 of the chapter, which we have read, those verses we did not read, begging God for help. And then he sent gifts ahead, rather extensive gifts, to mollify his brother, as we read in verses 20 and 21 of chapter 32, just before the section we began to read moments ago. Now, through the ages, a great many writers and preachers have gathered from all of this history that here we see Jacob once more, as we've seen him throughout the course of his life in the narrative of Genesis to this point, planning and scheming, seeking a way to get himself out of a jam and into some position of advantage. But finally, here at the Jabbok, with Esau bearing down on him with his 400 retainers, coming to the end of all that, and realizing finally and for the first time that he wasn't going to be able to bob and weave his way out of this predicament. His own cleverness, his aptness for double dealing would not be sufficient for this. And all along, this was God's plan and God's doing. That seems to me to be an entirely fair reading of the progress of this narrative and the tension that has grown to this breaking point at Genesis 32, verse 22. I would not say with Lloyd-Jones that Jacob becomes a truly religious man at this point, that he had no real faith in God before this, but I would say that it is clear that he needed to be weaned from his trust in his own wits and cleverness to a true and living dependence upon his God. He needed to be brought to the end of himself, to begin to distrust himself more profoundly. His self-reliance and his self-confidence had to be destroyed to make way for a more living faith in God. And so God brought him at last to a position of utter powerlessness and need. All he could see, humanly speaking, was the complete destruction of everything he had and was. His wives, his loved ones, his wealth, and finally his own life at the hands of his avenging brother. He remembered, no doubt, what he had done to this man, the galling treatment of his brother, of which he had been guilty, the grief it had brought his brother. He was left that night to imagine what was going through Esau's mind when he learned that Jacob was returning to the homeland. His sins at last had found him out, and now he's ready for prayer. As more than one wise man has pointed out through the ages, the rich, the healthy, and the happy seldom pray. At least they seldom really, really pray. And clearly here is the great point and insight and lesson of this history. Jacob, in the pressing circumstances of his life at that moment, was completely mistaken about the fundamental point. Just like you and I so often are, just like the world is 100% of the time. They are putting all the emphasis, all the worry, all the concern in exactly the wrong place. Jacob was completely mesmerized by this coming encounter with Esau, with Esau's wrath, with Esau's strength. That was his problem. That was the crisis of his life. That was the matter that now somehow needed to be resolved. That was what he had brought to God in prayer in verses 9 through 12. The roadblock, somehow he had to find his way around. He had made his plans. He'd sent ahead his gifts. He'd even prayed to God about his fears, had reminded God about promises that God had made to him long ago. But everything concerned the threat that Esau posed. And as he paced the Jabbok that night, what might come to pass in the morning when Esau arrived, this was all he was thinking about, all he was concerned about. But when God came to him in a most amazing way,
Esau is forgotten.
And the fears that circled around the prospect of the morrow, they recede into the background. God revealed to him that Esau was not his vital problem at all. Through the long struggle with God that night, Esau was forgotten, and Jacob learned, if not for the first time, at least he learned much better than he had understood this before, that the true problem and the crisis and the danger of his life came not from Esau. It had not come from Laban or any of the circumstances that he had faced, but they came from God himself. God was his problem, and his sin and his guilt was his problem, and all that would ever matter was to be right with God and have God's blessing. There's never been a time in the history of the world, I think, when the world worries so much about solving its problems as the world worries today. Or when a society such as ours worries so much about solving its problems. And when human beings, individuals, worry so much about solving their problems. We are a culture that is preoccupied with our problems. But invariably, all the attention, all the interest is placed upon the wrong object. The concentration is in the wrong place. And worry and work, as man does, even with all his might, his problems mount instead of diminish. For crime and poverty and injustice and damaged relationships and international tensions and so on the macro scale of human life, are not the true problem of the world, and alienation, and loneliness, and failure to achieve personal success and adjustment, these are not the real personal problems of man either. Those problems, those fundamental and basic problems, are man's relationship with God. That's the problem. That's the only problem. If that problem is resolved, all other problems are resolved with it. If it is not resolved, no problems are ever resolved. They are only exchanged for another set, usually worse. Jacob's real danger wasn't what Esau might do. It was what God might do. His real problem wasn't getting Esau to be reconciled to him. His problem was to be sure that God was reconciled to him. His great need wasn't to avoid Esau's wrath, it was to avoid God's wrath. And all of this time, he now discovered he had been pitting his strength and his wiles against God himself, not against Esau. No wonder he's there, worried to death, worried sick, walking up and down the bank of that stream. And through that long wrestling match, through that long night of struggle, Jacob found himself face to face with God, and everything else receded around him, Esau most of all. The night began with Jacob getting hold of God. These were hours of terrible and desperate spiritual conflict, and as Jacob experienced them, physical conflict as well. He wanted God to give him assurance that everything would be well with Esau on the morrow, a promise of protection from his brother. But no such assurance, no such blessing was given to him. He could not wring it from his foe. But the longer he struggled, the more conscious he became of his own condition, of his helplessness, his disreputable past, his hopelessness, unless God should grant him his favor and help, his utter lack of any claim on that favor and help. His self-reliance vanished, and with a startling clarity, he knew that he was utterly dependent upon God and what God would do for him and in him and with him. And if God didn't help him, he and his loved ones were doomed. And so he wrestled on in desperation until at last he obtained the blessing he sought, not specifically any promise of protection from Jacob, simply the promise of God's favor and the change of his name. The Lord made this point, the lasting lesson of this event, clearly, in Jacob's life and then in the Bible for us, by laming Jacob. What a perfect picture of the point, leaving him with a perpetual reminder of his weakness and of his need to lean upon God. Now remember, we're considering this encounter as one of the Bible's great images of private prayer. Jacob is alone. He's alone in the truest sense. He's alone spiritually and psychologically as well as physically. He's alone before God, which is, we said last Lord's Day evening, the great purpose and the great advantage and the great necessity of personal and private prayer. And the advantage is that he can meet with God and deal with him seriously and intimately and directly and personally, all of which Jacob does. What is astonishing and extraordinarily beautiful, I think, is the striking way in which God's condescension to us in such prayer is pictured here. You've noticed this as you've read this picture, read this passage and seen this picture. How can this possibly be true? God himself can't get loose from Jacob. How can that possibly be true? He has all power at his disposal. And that is, in fact, demonstrated in the passage itself by the fact that merely touching his hip, he put Jacob's hip out of joint. The divine inability, you see, is an inability of grace and mercy. It's an inability of promise and faithfulness. It's a self-imposed inability for our sakes. One ancient author put it this way: in Jacob, God is stronger than he is in himself. That is, in Jacob praying, God is stronger because God, being the faithful God that he is, cannot deny himself. He's promised to hear such prayers as Jacob prayed. He has said that if you seek me with all your heart, you shall surely find me. And Jacob did seek and find. Here is true private prayer, the prayer of a person who knows that his or her relationship with God and the blessing of God is really the only issue in his or her life. The only issue. Your relationship with God is the only issue in your life. Nothing else matters. All of the things that you worry about and all of the things you spend so much time concentrating on and all of the things that you plan and you contrive and you propose in order in one way or another to be able to manage your problems and get around them, all of that is nothing in comparison with your relationship to God. And knowing that, a man or a woman prays accordingly, absolutely unwilling not to be heard, because he cannot not be heard. He's lost if he's not heard. She is forsaken and helpless and hopeless if she's not heard. Here is prayer with no distractions, prayer that requires and obtains the total concentration of all of one's faculties, because it is prayer in which someone absolutely understands everything is at risk. Everything is here. My whole life is in this prayer. And this prayer, this kind of praying, with reverence we say it, but with this text behind us, this prayer is stronger than God. Now, do you know yourself how much there is in your life that is not at all really the issue, not at all really the problem? This difficulty, this person, this relationship, this set of circumstances, but really only God and yourself, and what is transpiring between the two of you, and the relationship that now exists between you. His blessing that you need, his anger that has risen up against you on account of your sin, his distance from you that has hardened your heart or made it cold, his smile that would solve and resolve that entire trouble that you find yourself in now. And have you then prayed so that you are wrestling with God himself and prayed with the strength and the perseverance and the determination and the unwillingness not to be heard with which Jacob prayed that night? He struggled with God and prevailed. God wants you to prevail with him. He loves. You know how it is, fathers. You have your little daughter, 2 or 3 years old, or your son, 3 or 4 years old, and you're wrestling with them on the living room floor, And over again you allow yourself to be thrown and pinned, and you hold their arm up as the champion once again in this wrestling match. Every one of you has done that. Why? You love to be beaten by your own children. You love for them to win. You have to let them win because you're so much bigger than they are. But you love to let them win. Why should we not suppose God thinks the same way about his children that we think about ours? That's true prayer. That's the prayer that makes a Christian and a Christian life. And that prayer has to be, you see it, don't you? That prayer has to be absolutely private, absolutely alone. And the more of that prayer there is in our lives, the more we will live with one eye always fixed on God, because he's the one we realize all the time. Out of that prayer, we realize is the real issue, the real substance of our life every moment, every day. One ear always turned to the voice of God because we're desperate to hear him bless us. And one hand always holding his. And that, my brothers and sisters, is the life that is worthy to be called life. And that man, that woman, will find out why God said and what he meant and exactly how much he meant when he said that a Christian can do everything, anything and everything, if only he does it through the one who gives him strength. Amen.